Okay, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what's happening? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Maybe you can tell by the slight audio difference than what it usually sounds like that I am not at home. I am in New York City. I am directly across from Central Park. I can look out the window and see horses and people and joggers and bikers. And it's beautiful here in New York looking over Central Park. Just to the left, there's some Trump-owned property that I went down to the restaurant and I sat there and they said, you want to look out the window at the door to the Trump Park or whatever it is? And I said, I don't know. I think I see enough of that name everywhere else in reality when I look at anything that maybe I'll look towards the lobby. That's New York City. Kevin Bacon is on the show today. That's exciting. I always wanted, you know, Kevin Bacon's one of those cats, you know, it's like there's always been a Kevin Bacon. You know, not the game aside, you know, it's just like throughout my whole life, we're about the same age, but he's just always, Kevin Bacon's always just right over there. Where's Kevin Bacon? Oh, he's around. And he's just always been part of my life, you know, as a personality, as an actor. And it was interesting to talk to him because he's a solid dude. He's a solid actor. He's always fucking good. And it was exciting to have the opportunity to talk to him. New York City is fucking beautiful. I'm happy to be here. I haven't been here in a while, but it has been very busy. I'll tell you why I'm here. Because we're doing what they call in the racket. I am here doing a bona fide press junket for the upcoming Netflix show, GLOW, The Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. I'm here with Betty Gilpin and Allison Brie. And basically what a junket is, and I'll be honest with you, this is the first time I've ever done this. I'm very proud of the show. It looks great. It's original. It's interesting. It's funny. It's deep. It's a world that you haven't seen before. And it's exciting. It's exciting to be part of it. I acted on my own series for 4 years, but that got little to no attention and certainly not a press junket. So this is my first time doing this. It's where Netflix has flown us out here. They've put us up at a hotel I usually don't stay at. It's fancy. And yesterday you get up in the morning and the three of us go to another location, another suite in another hotel. And we sit there in front of a camera crew. And every 4 minutes, someone from a different local or national network outlet comes in and interviews us with slightly different approaches to interview. 4.5 to 7 minutes for 3 hours. And, you know, you get a groove going and we've got a good chemistry, me and the ladies. And that was fun and interesting. Then you eat an okay lunch and then you go do a series of roundtables for print interviews for the next 3 or 4 hours. And then you do a little social networking platform stuff for Netflix. And then I come back to the room and then the ladies go do some other stuff because it's their show. It's the ladies' show. I'm just the guy on board. I'm the one guy in the world of women of GLOW, but it was great seeing people do the thing. You know, we all kind of have to do the thing in show business. You know, do the interview, turn on the juice. You know, sell the show, and just to watch it evolve over time, it's pretty amazing. There is professionalism. You know, whatever you think of whatever we do, and I certainly am not at the level of Allison in terms of acting or anything, but the, you know, the job of being in show business when you are working is pretty intense and it's beautiful to watch professionals do it. You know, there's a camaraderie here. We're in the same game, and some people are great at it and some people are okay at it, but you know, showing up for this stuff is pretty fucking exciting, and it was really fun to watch them, you know, do it as well. Is it okay if I have a good time in these end times? Is it okay if I have a good day, an exciting day, even though I'm still feeling a little under the weather? I hope this isn't the end of me. That's it. You know, I don't like being this age where, you know, you get a little buggy and then you're like, oh, is this it? Is this the harbinger of the end of me? Spent some time with my pal, Sam Lipsight. Had a little dinner. You know, it's wild when you don't see friends as often as you probably should see friends. And something I've learned from doing the podcast for so long is a lot of times you got to catch up. And a lot of times that seems like a very stilted process. And it seems somewhat, forced. So it's funny with me and Sam is that, like, when I see him, I'm like, you know, do you have a few hours? Because we're going to have to sit and do it. Because, you know, I haven't talked to him in months. So, you know, he's had his life going on. I got my life going on. He's got his problems. I got my problems. He's got his successes. I got my successes. So when we go out, you know, we meet, took a train, and you start the conversation. We get to dinner. You continue the conversation. But not unlike a podcast, sometimes it takes a while to break through to the engagement and the relaxation and the just hanging out part. And it's always sort of beautiful. There's an arc to it. It ends up, if it starts off a little like, God, things, ooh, eh. And then, you know, you have dinner and you get some laughs going, you get a little, you know, some thoughts going and you know, some ideas going just in conversation. And then you kind of, then we took a nice long 20-30 block walk and kind of eased into the friendship part and then just, you know, spending time together and talking it through. But over the 3 or 4 hours, you know, it all came together. That, you know, there's no editing with that. You know, you can't go back and cut things or add things. But sometimes to really connect with somebody takes some time, and you hang in there and you wait for it to happen if the relationship is important to you. It's just something you gotta do, and it doesn't get any easier the longer time you spend not talking to somebody. So stay in touch with the people you love, if possible. And, you know, have those nice long conversations. That's another little public service announcement from me, because it's worth it. It's worth it. Those things are important. You know, life goes by. You know, things seem daunting. Everything gets filled up. You get busy. You get distracted. All of a sudden, your time is being eaten by any number of things. Make sure you take time to really get in and connect with the people that are important. That's what makes life good. There are things that make it good. It's not just like, oh, I got to, and then I'm going to, and then like, oh my God, what happened? Is this going to, why I got to be the thing? And I don't know if I can do that. Oh, what's on for later today? Where do I got to be tomorrow? Why is that person calling me? Yeah. Shut it down. Take some time. Connect with some friends. Today's Thursday. So tomorrow I'm going to be in Philly. I think there's a few tickets for the Philly show. It's tomorrow night, May 12th at the Miriam Theater. I think there might be a few tickets for that. That's my second to my last date of this tour, which may be the final tour for a while. And then on Saturday, May 13th, I'm going to be down at the Warner Theater in the heart of the beast, Washington, D.C. I wonder how that place feels now that, you know, things are shifting. But I believe that show is pretty close to selling out at the Warner Theater. If you want tickets for either of these shows, you can go to WTFpod.com/tour and... go in, there's direct links for you there to go to the place that has the tickets. And on June 3rd, the next live appearance is BookCon. Also, there's a link for that at WTFpod.com/tour. That's me and Brendan McDonald, my producer and business partner, are going to be down there doing a thing for the book, Waiting for the Punch, which is very exciting. The more I think about that book, the more excited I am for you guys to get your hands on it. You can pre-order it. You can get that link, too, I believe, at the website under book. It's very clever. Waiting for the Punch. Yeah, you can pre-order the book. And I'll tell you, man, it's like it's so wild to read what people say. And it's just one of those books that you can pick up anywhere, you know, and just get into, you know, open it up anywhere and kind of engage with it. Sort of like conversation. But very proud of it and very excited to get it into your hands. So what else is happening? Next week, I'm gonna be shooting another episode of Joe Swanberg's Easy in Chicago. And then I think finally I get to relax as much as possible in the current world that we live in. It's been a long run between the tour, the podcast, Glow, the you know, shooting the special, everything else. I gotta stop for a minute. I'm not going to stop doing this, but I've got to figure out how to take a breath because my body is and my mind are wearing down. I'm certainly not complaining. I'm excited to be busy, I feel beat up, folks. I feel beat up. So I'm on the plane and I'm about to sit down in my seat. I'm coming from LA to New York, and who gets on the plane? Werner Herzog. Now, I thought I had a pretty good conversation with Werner Herzog, and a lot of times when I talk to people, even though it's for a nice long time, whatever my emotional connection in that hour or hour and a half or however long I spend with them is uniquely mine, it does not necessarily mean it's theirs or anything else. And a lot of times I run into him. I don't have any real expectations. I don't assume that we're friends. Some people I know and I see and I think I could be friends with. But generally, I don't socialize with people I meet on the podcast. But, you know, Werner Herzog, that was a big deal. That was a big day. And, you know, I felt like I had some familiarity with the guy that I could at least, you know, say hello. So, you know, he's getting on behind me and I'm about to sit down and I go, Mr. Herzog, how are you? And he looked at me like he had no fucking idea who I was at all. But, you know, I think that's the way he looks. And I go, it's me, Mark. You know, we talked in my garage. He's like, oh, yes, yes. Okay. You know, and I'm like, okay. Yeah. He's like, hi. And he just literally gave not a fuck, not one fuck. And, you know, I wasn't hurt. I wasn't surprised. I'd actually be surprised if Werner Herzog didn't do that. But there was part of me that I'm like, God, does he even remember that we talked? Is it, you know, and oh my God. And then it was kind of funny. I found it funny. I was not insulted. I was sort of happy that that's the way he responded. And, you know, and then I thought like, you know, okay, so he's sitting a couple of seats behind me. There's Werner Herzog. You know, what if the plane goes down? Would he be narrating it in his mind? The plane is crashing. They're screaming all around me. Smoke is filling the cabin. I realize now I know the man who said hello to me. It is of no consequence now. I do a terrible Werner Herzog, and I'm not good at impressions, but I thought it was a good idea. I thought it was a funny idea. That maybe he would remember me in that flat presentation. I'm not going to explain the fucking joke, folks. So Kevin Bacon is on the show. He's in this new series called I Love Dick, which I watched like three or four of, and I thought it was, again, not unlike a lot of shows now. It's like a completely surprising world that you would never know about, or it's hard to believe it even exists, but it's kind of an interesting show. Catherine Hahn is fucking genius in it. Griffin Dunn, also great, and Kevin is great. It's produced, executive produced by Jill Soloway. It premieres tomorrow, Friday, May 12th, again, on Amazon. It's an Amazon series. And this is me and Kevin Bacon back in the Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. Raj. So what? How's it going?
It's going pretty well.
Yeah, you don't live out here, though.
I finally, a few years ago, broke down and got a little place out here.
You did?
Yeah. So my wife and I were kind of like very committed LA haters. You know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I think so often we kind of defined ourselves with this New York kind of thing.
Right.
And she grew up in New York. I grew up in Philly, but I moved to New York when I was a kid, when I was like 17. So I definitely felt more connected to that.
Sure.
And, the reason, I guess was kind of complicated, but I think part was sort of like this, kind of love hate thing that I have with this, with the business and with the city and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, sure.
But, she was on a television show for 7 years. So it was for 7 years straight, 6 months of the year. some combination of the two of us was living either in a hotel or a rented house.
Right.
And eventually, on the at the very last year of her show, or I guess it was 8 years now that I think about it, we stopped and said, you know, I think we're really going to miss this neighborhood. And we were living in this great funky house. You'd appreciate this, this
around here.
Yeah and this house was built I think in the 20s, and it's owned by a Italian rock star. He's like the he's like the Bruce Springsteen of Italy, and he bought this house as an investment and rents it out. But what's super cool about it is that there was an old speakeasy that was built into the basement of the house. And the guy, and they turned it into a recording studio. So it's like this fantastic.
And you do the music.
Yeah.
Is it usable?
It's it's fantastic. So we rented that house and then moved up the street. And you know, I love LA now. I've completely turned around. I think it was I don't really know what it is growing up or changing my attitude or appreciating a different neighborhood, you know, kind of being like over on this side of town. And I don't know, now I'm like, I'm crazy about it. And frankly, I think my wife is kind of digging on it more than New York. I don't know if I'm quite there yet.
That's one of the things, though. I mean, you might, maybe you're a sociable person, but out here, one of the things, it's easy to get sort of isolated because you do have to drive. Like everything's diminished by the idea that sort of like, now we got to go to their house on the west side.
I know. I'm the same way. I'm like,
can't we meet him halfway?
Restaurant? Well, a lot of times we have those negotiations with our friends. We're like, let's look at the map and see.
There's got to be a restaurant somewhere between us.
But the thing is that they always have it worse because they've got to get it on the other side of the 405.
Yeah, I can't. I try to avoid the West Side entirely, and I hear it's nice. You know what I mean? I can't. I don't understand it. I don't do it. So it's weird. I think I have this thing where a connection, like I think you and I were on a gig in D.C., but you were playing in the band with your brother. I don't remember what it was for, but I think I did stand up and you did the, you guys closed it out, but I didn't talk to you.
Okay.
But like I have this weird connection, I think. Your brother, the guitar player, his name is it?
Michael.
Michael was a teacher at a camp I went to. Lighthouse Arts and Music Camp in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. Is that possible? I don't think he was there when I was there because he was like their big alumni and he came back and he played. Like Jim Croce also, I think, taught there.
Well, I know that he had played at a camp in PA.
Yeah.
But it was called Charlestown Playhouse. So I don't know if it, I don't know if the Lighthouse went in Pottsville, but it's certainly possible. Well, I'll have to ask him.
Well, yeah, I think he was actually like a teacher there. Like,
no kidding.
Well, that was the impression I got.
I might have forgotten about that, but he's 10 years older than me, so sometimes there's things in his life that I don't remember.
Well, you could have been 10. You could have done it in his 20s.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's fascinating. I'll ask him about
that. It's weird, man, because I remember him coming up and playing, and it was like, that's Kevin Bacon's brother, which has to be, at some point, sort of the bane of his popularity. But he's been playing folk music forever, right?
Oh, yeah. He's never done anything other than play music, and now he's a composer.
Doing a lot of movie stuff.
Does a lot of movie stuff and a lot of documentaries. And he also is a professor now. So he's teaching composing and film score and stuff like that. So he's, besides the band, he's got a whole lot of other, you know.
He made the shift. He was like, I got to make a living.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, you know, when you talk about what we do, you know, a lot of people have done other kinds of gigs in their life.
Yeah.
You know, I was a, you know, I worked in a warehouse and then I was a busboy and then I was a waiter. You know, I had a lot of sort of jobs. My brother's never done anything other than
playing guitar,
than make music and make a living at making music,
right?
Which is really like when I think about that, that's just kind of such an accomplishment.
It's crazy life, you know. And I'm glad that he's sort of evolved into these other avenues with it. You know what I mean? Because sometimes if you're just hammering away, playing the music, and things don't, and you don't, like, I had that moment where you get to a certain point in your life and things aren't working out and you don't know how, what are you going to fucking do?
Yeah, I know.
It's like, you know, like, I can't, what am I going to re-enter the workforce at 45?
Yeah.
The last job I had was like, you know, I was a grill cook.
Yeah.
You know, sort of like, yeah, maybe a restaurant.
Yeah.
Big gap in the resume.
No, I know. It's.
But when did you work?
Well, when I was got out of high school, I had a high school where if I did enough kind of gathering of credits, sort of, yeah, like it was set up more kind of like a college.
Yeah,
I could graduate early, so I got out half a year early, and then I was still down in Philly, and I was working packing and shipping medical books, and then it was the summer of 1976, and Philadelphia was getting excited about having the bicentennial.
Yeah,
and I joined up with this kind of avant-garde theater group. And keep in mind, I was literally like 17 years old.
Right.
And they let me in, and we were going to create sort of like a musical theater thing for this bicentennial that was going to be, and of course, I was really excited because here were these older actors, and a lot of them were, you know, beautiful women. They were probably, you know, 20.
Right.
But I thought of them as like, you know, older, kind of established people. And we would have these rehearsals where we would sort of like do theater games and, you know, trust exercises and, you know, pretend that you're an eggplant and all that kind of stuff. And it didn't really seem to be going anywhere. And I was simultaneously working in this warehouse to make some money. And I hadn't applied to college because I really didn't want to go to college, because I was so clear on the fact that I wanted to be an actor. And all of a sudden, about a couple of months before the bicentennial, I quit.
And you quit?
Yeah, I quit. I mean, it's like I was just such a cocky little shit. I was like, you know, I can't. I'm not gonna do this. I'm gonna go to New York.
Well, what was the plan for the big performance? Was it a guerrilla performance?
I think it was gonna be like a show. And you know, I don't even know if it ever got together. But it was a pretty, you know, they were definitely people who had sort of experience with this thing before. But I just said, you know, man, I gotta get to New York. You know, I loved Philly, but New York was like a giant magnet that was just kind of pulling me up.
That's where it happened.
And so when I got there, that's when I got a job as a busboy.
But did you do that? When did you start doing acting? I mean, you come from a huge family, right?
Yeah, I'm the youngest of six, but I don't remember ever not being an actor, even before I knew what an actor was.
Right, but did you do it in high school? Did you do plays and do that?
Yeah. I did everything I possibly could. I did every single play. We didn't have much theater in my school, but then I would work on the weekends. I apprenticed at a theater called the Manning Street Actors Theater.
Yeah.
And I would literally sweep the stage and, you know, anything I could do to hang around, you know,
right. So
the
it was,
boards.
Right, sure. Yeah. So it was a community theater? Like there was always people around. It had a full crew all the time.
Sure. There were a couple of community theaters in Philly. Manning Street was a little bit more of a professional theater.
Yeah.
I obviously wasn't getting paid, but there were people who were getting paid.
Did you see big shows there? Did you get an opportunity to like watch, you know?
I didn't really go to the theater that much. I really didn't. My parents didn't really take me, and you know, I didn't really have the money, and I would go to the movies.
Sure.
I started going to the movies, you know, as soon as I could. You know, it was that thing where all the good movies were R, let's face it, in the 70s, you know, all the good stuff from Coppola and
Ashby
Scorsese.
And De Palma.
De Palma, yeah, that was all the good stuff.
Yeah.
And they were all R, so like we would have to, you know, either pretend to be older than we were, you know, just try to figure it out. And I was not an old-looking guy, so that was hard. But I almost sometimes had a hard time watching movies because, especially when I was a little boy, because it was almost as though I wanted to get home and play that part. Like, it was so hard for me not to be in it.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, right.
To, like, look at it and not be a cowboy or not be, you know, whatever, an astronaut or fireman, you know. So, like, I would come home and just dress up as that thing and start pretending to be that thing. So that's what I mean.
You had an active fantasy life.
I did. I have a very active fantasy life, and I really always wanted to be another you know, another character.
Is that because were you, I have to imagine being the youngest of six kids, your parents were probably like, ugh.
Totally. Well, they had five kids, and then 8 years later I was born, so you do the math. I mean, there's no way they wanted to have another child.
Was that a Catholic thing?
No, they're not Catholic, no. Just
an accident?
Just an accident, yeah. And, you know, my mother kind of denied it, and I was like, oh, please. And then she eventually came around to calling, you know, me a happy accident or something like that. But you know...
So everyone was out of the house by the time you were 10?
They were, but even when I was very... Yeah, by the time I was 10, they were all gone. But even when I was really, really young, I can remember walking into a room and just wanting people to look at me and figuring out some way to be entertaining.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was like a very, very strong drive.
But that sort of makes sense to be in an emotional environment where they, you know, they just brought up five kids. Like, you must have on some level felt like, you know, where's the attention?
No. I didn't.
Oh, good.
It was awesome. I was such an independent kid. And look, I don't know if that's like nature nurture, right?
Maybe
they weren't giving me the attention, so I had to become that person.
Sure.
Maybe I naturally came out that way. I don't know.
Yeah.
But like I often say that when I left home, and I'm not sure they noticed that I had split. On the other hand, they were incredibly supportive of me doing what I wanted to do. Nobody ever said, don't you need something to fall back on?
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were very supportive.
And your dad was like, what was his game? What was his?
My dad was a city planner of Philadelphia for many, many, many years.
Oh, man.
And he was actually kind of an important person because he was at the time when... there was urban sprawl, not urban sprawl so much as white flight.
Oh, white flight.
White flight. And suburbs were becoming the place to be.
Right, and it just took all the blood out of the downtown.
Yes, and his life's battle was to bring life back to cities.
And they did it. They did it in Philly. Philly's like one of those places where I go and I'm like, this is great. Because it's got a, there's definitely a defined type that Philly is a place.
Yes.
It's like, you know, I go there, there's a couple of sandwiches I like. I know basically the type of dudes I'm going to run into.
Sure.
Yeah, but like that whole downtown area has been, you know, reborn.
Sure.
And your dad was sort of the beginning of that evolution?
He was, although I think that, he definitely was. And you know, by the time he, in some ways, some things were more successful than others, but it was his... It ran through his veins, and just cities in general. I mean, he was obsessed with all cities.
Was he saddened that they were dying, or you know, because it was so vital in his mind?
He was, and the older he got, the more sort of like impassioned he got.
Yeah.
And he didn't get less passionate; he got more passionate and more kind of like eccentric and stuff. I mean, I'll give you an example. He long after he retired. In fact, I think he was about 92.
Wow, he lived for a while.
Yeah,
huh?
He lived till he was 94, but I think he was about 92 or 90. There was a park in Philly called Love Park, and it's called Love Park because it has that L-O-V-E.
Oh, the sculpture.
Right? And it became a mecca for skaters.
Yeah.
Loved it because they could grind on all these built-in things. And basically, they were kind of like the only ones who were using it.
Uh-huh.
And the city came to them and said, you can't, you know, you're fucking up all the furniture and all the you know, the
right.
Everything is like being destroyed. So we have to kick all the skaters out of Love Park. And my father...
There's no love there.
There's no love there, right. So it became illegal, okay,
right,
to be on a skateboard in Love Park.
Yeah.
He went down and got on a skateboard, tried to get arrested.
At 92?
Yeah, they put a helmet on him, and had a couple of people hold him and like rolled him around on a skateboard. I think there's actual video of it.
Yeah,
and I don't think the cops actually arrested him, but that was his dream because he actually at that age, believe it or not, I'll run into skaters that'll say, "Oh, your dad was the music dude. Your dad is such a hero for us, man." And I think they actually have ended up having like a not having anything to do with him, but I think there's actually a Love Park video game or something like that.
So
it's like that kind of stuff, like the
a skateboard video game.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
People using spaces, public spaces, was really, really important to him.
So that's and so are all your sibs still around?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Did any of them, any other ones other than your brother Michael go into show business?
No. Mm-mm, no.
Did they go into city work? Did they
Some are in city work, and one is a events planner. Another works for Arts Council in Vermont, and another is in the private sector. You know, they're in a whole bunch of other stuff, and we're very very close.
Really, that's group. Great.
Yeah, yeah. We
do the big family thing.
We do. We have a giant Thanksgiving. We don't do Christmas, but we do a giant Thanksgiving.
Well, that's nice.
It's amazing. We do it at our house in New York at our apartment.
And everyone's got kids, so there's like 50 people there.
It's it's usually about between 40 and 50.
Oh my
God. Because my wife has a big family too. You know, she's got like a Brady Bunch kind of family.
Right, so. And she's like deep New York. They're all around, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy. It's my favorite. It's my favorite holiday. I mean, because what's wrong with eating and giving thanks?
No, nothing. And you know, sometimes once a year you see everybody, it's good.
It's awesome.
For most people that's like just the right amount. Yeah, then we got that day or two and then we're out. When you started the acting, because like it's weird that when you were coming over, like my memory of you is pretty entrenched, like you're part of my cultural upbringing. Mm-hmm. Kevin Bacon was sort of always there. Mm-hmm. Somehow. But when you started, I mean, really young, going to New York. So did you train, or were you just driven by cockiness? How did it work?
I did train.
With who?
I went to the Circle in the Square Theater School first as a in their summer program, which was really for like high school age kids, and then I asked them if I could audition for their winter thing. It was a 2-year program.
Yeah,
and they said you're too young, and I said, can I please just audition? And I got into that. And so I was going to school there, working as a waiter.
At Circle in the Square.
Yeah, I was going to Circle in the Square and working as a waiter or a busboy, depending on which place I was at, but at night, and trying to, learn as much as I could and try to make a living. And
well, from those days, like what things did you learn then that you still use?
Yeah, it's funny because I was in school because I kind of felt like I needed to be in school.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I also had this sort of attitude that there was nobody that could teach me anything.
Yeah.
I was so, such a combination of like confidence for absolutely no reason. and also terrified,
that's the artist line. That's the edge we go on.
Just right.
Paralyzing fear and weird cockiness.
Exactly. I feel like you need to have that kind of,
sure.
Combination of that. It's like the emperor's new clothes, right? You're going to be exposed,
right.
For being a fraud, in order to not be exposed for being a fraud, you got to pretend like you know what the fuck you're doing. And I didn't. While I was in school, I often felt like I don't really know why we're doing this, and I don't know why this teacher is saying this, and it was kind of more about me trying to do well or do better or get compliments or something like that. But the truth is that now, and for many years, I'll go back and I'll think about something that I was taught.
Oh, yeah?
And I'll go, they were absolutely right. Like, that was, like, if I had just listened to that, you know what I mean? Like if I left myself a little, everyone's got their journey, right?
So,
it doesn't really matter. It's worked out okay. But if I'd left myself open to the fact that there were people who could teach me, not just about acting, but also about, like, the business.
You know?
Like, I had an agent who just passed recently. And he was, my first agent and stuck with me for years and years and years. But it's like I never let him guide me in a weird sort of way.
Did he offer?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. And I was just, oh, I got this. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do this. I'm not going to do that. You know what I mean? And really, I think that if I could tell, the younger me something, that's what I would say. It's like, dude, just people know shit. like
right.
from being having been around and seen things.
Hard to trust people, though. You know, it's hard to trust people in the sense that you don't know, especially in this business, whether someone's coming at you for their own benefit or, you know, actually thinking about your best interest.
But did you have a mentor or were you able to look at other, you know, comics and say,
sure.
Or listen to their advice or?
Well, you know, with comedy, it's a little easier. You know, you sort of like, what is the tone? You know, it's all you up there. So, you know, you're in a narrow context. So how are you going to use that thing? You know, who, you know, you can look up to people and like people's comedy and aspire to honesty or one line, whatever mm-hmm. it's going to be. So it's a little more of a gypsy sort of approach.
But you still have to be yourself.
Well, yeah, you want. That's ultimately what I wanted to get at. Mm. But, you know, in terms of business, I didn't understand show business till a few years ago. You know, I mean, I'm in my garage, dude. Like, you know, I was a stubborn asshole, and I never understood that, you know, maybe it's good to be diplomatic and acknowledge that, you know, that assistant's going to be the king of Hollywood at some point, that people hold grudges, and that, you know, you can fuck yourself real easy.
Mm.
Yeah, just by being cocky.
Mm,
I learned that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, fortunately, I landed on my feet somewhat.
Sure did.
But I don't know. I believe that people who act, there's a lot of natural talent there. I mean, either you can do it or you can't on some level. I mean, like, there's a lot that you can't explain, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I think that's true. But I also think you can get better. I mean, when I look at... which I really don't because it makes me so nuts.
It does? But,
yeah, to look at early work, I mean, I just go, oh, fuck.
Well, how'd the first role come? I mean, I remember you as Fenwick? I remember Fenwick.
Animal House was the first movie that I ever did.
Right.
And it wasn't my first role because I was very, very into theater. And although I ended up on soap operas, but that was actually after Animal House.
What kind of theater were you doing?
I did all off Broadway, regional theater.
Weird shit?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was thinking about the other day about research, you know, how you throw yourself out. I was talking to John Lithgow in an interview about the research that both of us had done to do those parts in Footloose. I was thinking about a play that I did called 40 Deuce, which was probably back in the late 70s. I was playing a male prostitute drug dealer. In those days, they called him a chicken.
Yeah.
And there was a bar and an area in Times Square where these young boys would get off the bus and go, and they would meet these Johns at this bar.
The Terminal Bar?
It was actually called, I think it was called the Haymarket.
Yeah.
And I spent like a lot of time being that guy. Now, I'd never turned a trick.
Right.
But when I think back on that, first off, I was able to do that kind of research.
And were you like 20?
No, like 18.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I get like 18 or 19, I would think. Then there was 53rd Street, where at night these guys would cruise, and I would go down there and walk around. And you know, like, it was... so interesting to be in a situation where nobody knows who you are.
Yeah.
Obviously. It's something that I couldn't really do now.
Right.
And to just look at a different side of life that's not your experience.
And it's a little menacing.
It was menacing. Oh, yeah. It definitely was. It definitely was.
So you're out there like presenting yourself as meat.
Yes.
You're getting all that weird juice.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But... those experiences were incredibly rich and helpful too. You know, in terms of just playing the part,
it did help.
Oh yeah, for sure. So that's the kind of theater to answer your question that I was doing, down and dirty and very very kind of strong character kinds of parts.
But you took it on yourself to like research is an important part of your trip.
Yeah.
You know, in order to build the guy.
Yeah.
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 And that sticks. That still happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you go, well, what good did it actually do? And you don't really know. It's very hard to look at the performance and go, oh, I got that from doing that.
Sure.
You know, what I was talking to John Lithgow about was when I got the part in Footloose, I was 23, I think, or 24. Yeah. And I was supposed to be playing a 17-year-old high school student.
Yeah.
And I was afraid that I wasn't I was like, how can anybody think of me as a 17-year-old? So I checked myself into the high school in Utah where we were shooting as a student that had just moved to town. So basically, with the help of the high school principal and the guidance counselor, I was able to create for a day that experience that the character in the movie was going through. Now, none of the students knew and none of the teachers knew.
Yeah.
And that was, for instance, like very, very informative.
How they treat you.
Yeah. Well, they treat me like shit. I mean, the thing is that, here's the thing, is that I had this idea that if I'm from a big city, right, and streetwise or whatever, if I go to a small town, I'm going to be a badass. Like, I'm not going to, you know, these
got to make your mark.
Yeah. Like these, you know, farm boys.
Cow pokes.
They're not going to, you know. The second I got there, I was like, oh, shit, I am so out of my element. And it was very much like the movie. People making fun of me, making fun of what I wore.
In one day?
In one day, my hair, girls giggling, one guy coming up to me, taking me under his wing, showing me the ropes.
Yeah.
Teachers not being very nice to me. I mean, like, it was amazing, like, microcosm of what that movie was.
And it's also, I guess, amazing how well written the thing was, because it nailed it, right?
It did. Although I have to say, I did change a few things based on that experience. Not much, but I mean, just little kind of details. But Well, I mean, this is funny. This popped into my head. I'll give you an example.
Yeah,
is that this is during the time of that look, you probably know, where you had skinny ties and it was like men
new
at
wave.
Work. New wave, right? Yeah, yeah. New wave. It was kind of, and I was a really big Police fan, you know, that whole thing. And in the script originally, it's the mother says to me, "Shouldn't you wear a tie and a jacket if you're going to the first day of school?" And I say, "Mom, I'm not going to wear a tie." And what I realized is that a skinny tie, was going to be way weirder than what she was suggesting.
Yeah.
So we switched it around. So I'm putting a tie on.
Yeah.
And she's like, "Are you really going to wear that tie?" And when I show up at this school, the guys are in jeans and,
high school.
Yeah. Plaid shirts and
70s,
stuff.
Yeah.
And here I am with a kind of a jacket and a groovy tie. And it's like, I'm way more out of, you know.
I remember when that happened in high school, because I'm 53. So I was in high school when the new wave thing took hold.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody started wearing buttons, thin ties.
Yeah.
The Knack, My Sharona.
Yeah, there you go.
That's what turned it, I think.
That's right.
Well, that's wild, man. But wait, let's go back, because Animal House is pretty important.
Well, they sent the casting director to the school.
Yeah.
And I didn't have an agent.
To the Circle rep?
To Circle in the Square,
Circle in the Square,
And the casting director said to the school, "Do you have any kids that might work as like a preppy college freshman?"
Yeah. An asshole. Preppy asshole.
Who's your preppy? Who's your best? Do you have a preppy asshole here? They're like, "Yes, we do." step right this way.
Yeah.
So they sent me over and I had this meeting basically with the casting director. There was really very little for me to read. I mean, I don't know if I had a lot of lines.
Right.
I mean, I did have a couple lines, but not a lot. And then they sent me back to meet with John Landis, who was the director. And he said, "I want you to make a face like you're smarmy. Smarmy. I want to see if you're smarmy." And I literally had no idea what smarmy meant, but it's kind of an onomatopoeia, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I just kind of went, you know, it's radio.
Yeah.
I made a face.
Yeah.
And he was like, that's it. I love that. You know?
Yeah.
And so then I got a call back, and then the guy just called me up and said, "You got to get on a plane in a couple of weeks." And
that face came in useful. I remember that face.
It was horrible. Yeah. Just absolutely awful.
Yeah.
But yes, it did come in.
Like that one note, it kind of informed that whole character.
It did. It absolutely did. It absolutely did. And then, speaking of kind of research, what was interesting about the Animal House situation was that, first off, I mean, talk about an amazing kind of like, oh my God, here I am. I'm in a movie. This is so fucking cool.
Right.
I flew
to Oregon, and I'd never been, I'd hardly ever been on a plane, but I'd definitely never been in first class.
Yeah, right.
And everything about it was just like crazy, crazy cool.
Yeah.
But Landis kind of created a situation, I think on purpose, where he wanted to bring the Animal House, the cool guys, right, out early and have them sort of bond, which they did.
Yeah.
They went to a frat party, they got into fist fights, you know, they got drunk, they had like a really bonding thing. And wanted to kind of separate the rest of us, the losers, you know, the assholes, from the cool people. And what actually happened was that actually happened. And they really wouldn't hang out with me.
Yeah.
And that was a difficult for me.
Like Belushi and Matheson. And
you know, John was in a different kind of category, honestly, because he was flying back and forth for Saturday Night Live.
Right.
And he had a house, and he wasn't staying in the same hotel as the rest of us.
Yeah.
You know, but everybody else, I'll tell you, this is an absolute true story. It's funny. I was seeing this waitress at the hotel.
Yeah.
And these guys would have parties all the time in one of the guys' rooms.
The cool guys?
Yeah, the cool guys.
Yeah.
In fact, they took a upright piano and wheeled it across the parking lot. I don't know where they got it from, like a conference room or something like that, and stuck it in one of their rooms.
Yeah.
So they would have like, there were musicians there. They would play, I think Bruce McGill played the piano, and it was like always this amazing fucking party going on that I was never invited to.
Yeah.
And so this waitress says to me one night, listen, you should know that the FBI is watching the cast and the company and the hotel and this entire shoot. And they know all about, you know, the drugs, and they know all about everything that's going on. And you should just know that. You know, she had I don't know how she knows about the FBI, but I was, you know, at that moment, high enough to be like super paranoid.
Right.
So I thought that a good way in would be to tell these guys that was going on.
Right.
That I would be sort of like a hero.
Yeah.
You know, right? Because then everybody would like turn the music down or whatever, just be cool. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I called up, and they're having a party down there. And I called up, I think it was Bruce McGill's room. And I'm like, hey, listen, it's Kevin, Kevin Bacon. I'm the guy that plays it, you know.
Yeah.
And listen, the FBI, I just want you to know, because I have a pretty good authority that the FBI has been in town, and they're like watching everything and watching you guys and watching the hotel. And I heard the music going on in the background. He's like, fuck you. Slams the phone down. Nothing ever happened.
You didn't get the confirmation or anything. The waitress just had some inside info.
No.
So that movie was huge. And then what happens after that?
I went back to waiting tables.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I went back to waiting tables. And I've told this story before, but I had to ask for the night off to go to the premiere of Animal House. I had that night off from the restaurant. My boss said, yeah, sure. It's, you know, it's your big premiere.
Right. Yeah, there you go. Go ahead, but make sure you're back tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. Right. Yeah. And it was really, really terrible because I got down there. I took the subway down to the Times Square where the theater was, and there was a red rope, but I was on the other side of the red rope, and I saw the cast all arriving. So like, they had a tier, I guess, of kind of tickets and you know, and those guys, of course, I mean, I've just had a small part, you know, but they were like the Animal House and like, you know, the guys. And so like, here I am at my big Hollywood premiere, and I'm like watching it sort of like from a distance. And I get down to the seats, and I don't have the right seat to get past the, you know, the line where the good seats are. Then I get down to the party, which was down at the Village Gate, and I didn't have the ticket to get into the VIP, and
so they were still icing you.
The cool kids were icing me, exactly. And I had this idea that because I was in the movie, I was going to be beating women off with a stick.
Sure.
Because everyone would recognize me and yeah. You know, I was now...
The asshole that all the women want to be with,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
That guy.
Yeah. They so didn't want to be with me, nor did they... I remember talking to a girl and trying to convince her that I was actually even in the movie.
Yeah.
And I got so depressed that I went back to the restaurant and just hung out with my friends at the Allstate Cafe.
What a sad premiere story.
Isn't that... just tragic.
And then Levinson cast you. Like, did you go back to soap operas and shit?
I did. Yeah. Then I went on the soaps. Yeah, I was on the Search for Tomorrow and the Guiding Light. No, not Search for Tomorrow. Search for Tomorrow. Yeah, and the Guiding Light. And I was doing theater. And
but you were working. All that stuff adds up, right?
It all adds up.
I mean, doing soap operas, whatever that's like.
No. Great. Believe me. I started working. Pretty quick. I mean, relatively quick. I mean, sometimes I would run out of money, so I'd have to go back to waiting tables. And I had a boss that was like really like cool about that. And probably I'd say three times I said, "I'm done."
Yeah, this is it. Yeah,
yeah. And then I'd have to go back.
Because I remember like when I saw like Diner was a huge movie for me. And I'm assuming I'm assuming it was a huge movie for you.
It was a huge movie and amazing, amazing memories, you know, of making something. I mean, sometimes we'll get together, like I'll see one of the guys, you know, Riser, I still see, or I'll, you know, run into Danny or Timmy or whatever. And we have had almost kind of like reunions with Barry and stuff, Barry Levinson. And, there's more stories for us packed into that 7 week shoot or whatever it was than 100 other movies.
Really?
It was just a really fun, intense and interesting kind of time for all of us, I think.
In the sense that you were all young actors and this was like, was it a loose environment in that you all really got to know each other and you had and you were all sort of hungry and excited?
Or? Yes. And none of us were, some of us had been working, but none of us were stars, except I would say maybe for Mickey, who was just kind of like exploding based on the thing that he had done in Body Heat.
The bomb guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we were in this hotel in Baltimore, just guys, single guys hanging out. And what was interesting was that if you look at the movie, it's almost kind of random, like who happens to be together at any given time. Sometimes there's three guys together, sometimes there's two, sometimes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of not all that well planned out in terms of that.
Yeah.
But the guys that were together would be hanging out on the set.
Right.
Together, having a fun time.
Yeah.
And the guys that weren't at work that day would go and hang out and do something else. So there was this kind of like thing where all of our different relationships were all sort of...
genuine?
Yeah, and they all sort of bounced off each other in interesting ways. And it was also a deal where Barry Levinson did kind of the same thing about bringing us down there early for what he called rehearsal, but it was really just a bonding kind of session.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a lot of authentic sort of, you know, interaction. Like he was able to honor each of your personalities.
There was.
Within the character. Like it really, like that was the first time I was like, when I saw Paul Reiser, I thought he was hilarious. And I had not really seen him do comedy. And I knew him like from that movie. Mm-hmm. And when I was in college, I don't remember when that movie came out. So this is my first year of college. And I saw that. And I thought he was hilarious and all you guys were great. But then I went to the comic strip and he was there just sitting there. And that's when I asked him, I said, I want to do comedy. How do I do it?
No kidding.
Yeah. Ah. Because of Diner. And he was like, I don't know, you just do it. And I'm like, great. That's what I tell people. It's like, you know, spend your life afraid, just get it out of your system, see if you like it.
Yeah. Well, Reiser was amazing because he didn't really on paper have much of a part. Like when we auditioned for Diner, you would go in and pick one of the parts to read. I wanted to either play Boogie because he was cool, the part that Mickey played.
Yeah.
or the part that Tim Daly played because he was romantic. So I was like, either I want to be cool or I want to get the girl. I read both of those. Barry went, why don't you read Fenwick? I was like, Fenwick, I don't know Fenwick. Is there anything there? I didn't say that, but I was disappointed, frankly, that I had gotten Fenwick because I thought the other parts were better and flashier and more interesting. And he was such a reactive kind of character. But when Reiser got down there, he almost had no part.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, we would get into these, like, rehearsal situations, and he just fucking starts improvising. And Barry's like, that's so funny. I love that.
Yeah, I'm not comfortable with the word nuance.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Or, you know, are you going to eat that or whatever?
Yeah, right.
Because he's brilliant with that.
Yeah.
And now I see this guy's, like, part start to get bigger and bigger and bigger. I'm like, this fucking guy, Jesus.
Reiser's eating the movie.
He's eating the movie. Well, you know, I made a choice when I realized that I didn't consider myself as a good improviser.
Right.
And I was intimidated by Paul's skill, but even by all of them. You know what I mean? They were all really good at that. Danny and Timmy,
Steve.
And Mickey and Steve. Steve, you know, would just kind of say crazy shit and it was just fucking funny and Barry would love it. So I was very intimidated by that. And I literally made a choice that I needed to not be the guy that comes up with the funny thing to say. That I'm the guy that sits there and reacts to what everybody else is saying.
An important laughs. Part.
Yeah, because in any kind of dynamic, you know, if you have a bunch of friends that, you know, hang out.
Yeah.
There's always one guy that's like the wise ass and, you know, there's other guys that just sit there and laugh.
Sure.
Or, you know what I mean? So that was kind of like what I chose. And I think that ultimately it worked out better.
Well, yeah. And your character is really, out of all of them, the most troubled character.
He is. He's a mess.
What did you make decisions about your career at that point? Because you never stopped working, but what were some of the challenges of being Kevin Bacon at that point as an actor?
There were a lot of challenges, both professionally and personally, because I had a real difficult time with the kind of pop star aspect of it.
The Footloose?
Yeah, of that
right.
Super, super kind of like, pop star.
The kids loved it.
Yeah, and it's exactly what I didn't want to be. I so desperately, from the time I first set foot, even before I got to New York, wanted to be a serious actor, whatever the hell that means. That's like what I wanted to do. I wanted to do theater. I wanted to be
De Niro.
You know,
or
De Niro and Meryl Streep and Dustin and John Voight, you know, like you know,
respected.
Yeah, work with Cassavetes, you know what I mean? Like this was the stuff or theater or you know, Kevin Kline, you know.
Yeah.
And now I was a pop star. And
almost
so,
it's like one it's like the next level, it's just above child actor.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And everything that I had done up to that point was sort of, nobody knew it. You know what I mean? Doing an off Broadway play is, you feel that it's just as important, but nobody fucking knows it.
Right.
You know,
right.
So it doesn't really.
Yeah, we made a difference tonight.
Yeah.
For those 12 people.
For those 12 people. Exactly. Exactly. And so I had a hard time. I was very resistant of it. And again, if I had been open to people giving me advice, people would have said, look, embrace it. Take it as far as you can take it. And then just do good work. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Just, take your time with the choices that you're going to make.
But use the sort of star turn capital.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what did you choose to do?
I just made bad movies, you know? I just made bad choices, you know, and sometimes
out of stubbornness.
Oh God, I don't know. I feel like it was self sabotage.
Mm.
I think it was a. I think I, and again, look, you know, I don't have much of a rear view mirror when I think about these things because I like to look down the road and stay moving forward.
Yeah.
And I also feel like, again, the process by which you get wherever you get is the right process for
has
you.
To be.
Has to be. You can't go back and change time. And so I learned a lot, you know, from that, from making bad choices. And then I was able to, you know, kind of turn things back around. So you know, it was the right thing for me to go through.
You know, oh, The Big Picture, that was a sweet movie. That was a good choice.
Yeah, nobody saw it. So, like, I like the movie. I think it's great. I love Chris Guest. I had a blast making it. You know, Chris Guest, I mean, has an unbelievable ability to take something that is really, really true and really, really familiar and make it hilarious. And, you know, when you see some of the characters, like the studio executives, and Marty Short is my agent, you know, and you go, can these people, like, did these people actually exist in Hollywood? And then you meet them, and then they're like, it's like exactly the same. I mean, there's things in that movie that my wife and I still use to this day. I mean, Marty Short has a great line where he says, he's having the first meeting with him, and he goes, Nick, I don't know you. I don't know your work, but I think you're very talented. And it's like, to me, that's like, you get that shit all the time. Yeah. You know, killing you with kindness.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because that was a big sort of shift, like in, I imagine, in Guest's, you know, kind of vision, like, because he went the whole in completely improvisational direction. I mean, that was a pretty tight movie.
Right.
And that was written.
Right. He went straight to mockumentaries.
Yeah.
After Spinal Tap.
Which are, you know,
Although Spinal Tap, I think he did right before The Big Picture.
And, but that was, he was acting in that,
right,
really,
exactly,
right?
That, right?
But then, like,
right,
his whole oeuvre is now these weird kind of, like, improvised right, masterpieces. Eugene Levy.
So brilliant.
So then you do, like, JFK and Few Good Men, Power Pack. That was a good punch. Good 1-2 punch. Well, you had a couple movies in between there. I'm sorry I'm doing this, but, like, you've done so much, I have to.
It's all right.
But, like, I thought A Few Good Men, like, was, that was a fucking astounding performance.
Well, you know what? I thank you for that.
Should have won an Oscar, buddy.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
You got a chip on your shoulder about that?
About the Oscars?
Yeah.
I think that to say that, that's a tough question, I'll tell you, to answer, because on one hand, if you say I really don't care,
right,
then it's obviously bullshit,
right,
and it's gonna feel like false humility. Clearly, you're lying.
Yeah.
And if you say you care a lot, then you just look like a bitter, you know, fucking asshole. And the thing I always remind myself is that, well, first off, of course I would like to even be nominated for anything, which doesn't really happen.
Won something. Have you?
A couple of things here and there, but of course, and part of the reason is that it opens up more opportunities, right? Because, for instance, there's a certain kind of movie that's made for a certain kind of budget that's going to come out in the fall. And when those people are putting those movies together, what they want to put on the poster is Oscar nominee from this Oscar nominee.
Ticket sellers.
Yeah, it's a selling of the tickets, but it's also positioning it in a way that's going to become an Oscar movie. And especially in this day and age, in order for something to break out that's serious at all, it has to get awards consideration.
I think the best way to look at it is sort of like, it's something I'd like to experience once in my life. I'd like to get one of those.
There you
once.
Go. There you go. Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, but the truth is that when somebody comes up to you and says, "I loved," you know, when you say that was important to me, Diner, for instance, you know, that's like I can really, like, I can put that on an imaginary shelf.
Oh yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The impact you have on people. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was a life changing movie for me, really.
Right. Well, good.
But so that means something. That means more, ultimately, the impact you have on people that you don't even know. Like, even this podcast, you know, you get these emails from people like, "Thank God." And I'm like, well, that's that, you know, that's what you do it for.
No, I know. I've heard you read some of them. It's very touching, actually. It is. Yeah. No, it really is.
I get them all the time, man.
No,
I cry here. I sit here and cry reading my emails.
No, it's very touching.
Yeah. But that movie was sort of, that part was so controlled. And so, like, there's a moment in that movie where, like, when you make choices like that, because whatever you made decisions you made about your acting career, you've had a very varied career, and these characters are very different, and even the ones that seem similar are incredibly different. Like the humility of that guy, of that Marine, was he a Marine?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where, you know, he knew that moment where that moment happens, where, you know, Nicholson does that, and you're in that position, that moment where you got to be like, you know exactly what happens next. Mm-hmm. This guy doesn't go home.
Right, right.
And he doesn't seem to know that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then, you know, that moment with Cruise, I mean, that was a somehow or another, there was a lot of humanity in that thing.
That was a great run at that point, and I'll tell you why. Because the first part of that was JFK.
Right.
And then Murder in the First, and A Few Good Men, and The River Wild. And what was good about that was that I was a character actor, and I realized that that's really what I was. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
because after
yeah.
Footloose, I was sort of trying to get into this, whatever it's called, leading man kind of box.
Right.
And even back that in the 80s, there was more of an instinct in our industry to make somebody into a leading man or make them into a character actor.
But then there's only like 9 of those guys.
Right. So exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And I wasn't one of them ultimately.
And you had that moment of realization?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I had it's, you know, we talk about leaving yourself open to advice.
Yeah.
I had an agent who said to me, this is what we need to do. And you need to get back to this. And you need to stop focusing on the size of the part and all that other shit.
Yeah.
You know, and she sent me to meet Oliver Stone, and I did JFK. And that literally like spun things, both like in terms of perception, but also in my mind. The thing is that—
And you were able to use that research from 53rd Street.
Exactly. I was. Well, I did some even crazier research for that. That's a whole other thing. Oh my gosh.
What?
Well, you know, the guy that I was playing was based on a real guy, and he was a fascist sort of gay, well, I guess he was gay.
Yeah.
But really into like leather, and I don't even want to, you know, certain kind of like really hardcore kind of sexual
yeah.
stuff. And Oliver Stone wanted me to hang out with the guy. So I did. I spent like the night.
Oh, he's still alive.
He was alive when we made the movie. Yeah. Off. He's still alive. Spent the night running around to all these leather bars in New Orleans. And I was like, fuck. And it was actually the night, it was night of the cast dinner, which was like, I was like, Jesus, thanks, Oliver. You know, he sends me a, but Gary Oldman was in the movie.
Yeah.
And
he was Oswald, right?
Yeah. And Gary, yeah. And Gary I call Gary. I'm like, dude, can you do this run with me? He's like, okay. And it was so sweet of him. So me and Gary ran around with this lunatic.
Yeah.
Throughout. Anyway, that was an amazing evening.
Yeah. And saw a lot of stuff, learned some things,
yeah. But you know what? When I wanted to be an actor, it was always about wanting to put on a different hat every time, you know, wanting to, you know, to be a different guy. Like, yeah. To me, that's what being an actor was. I mean, when I look at Meryl Streep, you know,
right.
she's like the best at that, because when you line them all up, it's, you know, some of us have tried that, but then the most successful ones are kind of right in the same pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
When I look at her, I go, okay, I totally believed her as this one. I totally believed her as this one. And they don't, like in terms of like the social upbringing or you know, whatever, those two people couldn't be any more
yeah,
different.
It's kind of fascinating like that. You don't see the you don't see the technique.
Right.
And right. You're like sort of like, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah. So that's the type of thing.
I think you do that, definitely.
Well,
and I think you're afforded that as a character actor.
What I do appreciate, if I was to get you know, like I said, I have a lot of gratitude about being able to make a living at all as an actor or as any kind of an artist. You know as well as I do that that's a real struggle. The thing that I really appreciate is that when I get offered things, they're pretty varied.
Yeah.
Like, not in terms of like the kind of characters that come my way, they're varied not only in terms of the men, but also the genre. You know, things come that are, you know, funny, and things come that are dark, and things come that are intense and weird, and you know.
Man, you have, like, there's some moments of the weird humanity that, like, because I'm flashing back on some moments of your roles. Like, I don't remember the JFK role clearly, but I certainly remember that moment in A Few Good Men, and I remember the moment in Sleepers. No, but it's the weird moment that I remember is when he finds you after, when you're just this fucking drunk, nothing.
Thank you for that. And I really appreciate that.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and you just see in your eye that it's, you know, you're just completely morally bankrupt and done. And you know, and that's when, that was the fucking moment. Not the moment where you're fucking doing horrible things to kids.
Right.
But where, like, the humanity of that moment is like, you know, what's going to happen now to that guy? Because you have a moment of not empathy, but like, that guy looks like he did himself in.
Yeah, he's a little man.
Right.
Yeah, he's a little man. And he gets 7 in the chest.
Yeah. But you're okay with that, though.
Oh, I mean, yeah. People, I love it. You know, if I play a character like that and you go to the movies and people cheer after he gets blown away, you know you've done a good job, you know. Well,
that movie, I thought, was so good. And I remember at the time there were some issues with, I don't know what people's issues were with it, but, you know, because the book was so fucking brutal. But I thought the movie was good.
That was Barry Levinson.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, so you work with him again. But like, in again about, you know, 4 friends in a much more horrible circumstance.
Yeah.
You know what's really weird is, like, some movies really don't do as well as they should because they have horrible endings, like, yeah, or tragic.
Maybe that's, yeah. Well, look, I mean, I always say that the last, you know, 5 minutes, first off, can take kind of a mediocre movie and make people have a really good feeling about it.
I remember that movie, but it was heavy, dude.
Yeah.
But and Apollo 13, another, you're real good with groups of guys. Like, in some weird way, right?
Uh-huh.
Paxton was in here like a week before he passed.
Was he? Oh, Jesus.
It was so good that he was here, and so sad what happened. But so God sad. Damn it. I'm glad I had that time with him.
Yeah. He's a great dude.
Oh, my God.
Really, really fun. So much enthusiasm and...
And always delivers, man. You know, he gets on the screen and it's sort of like, you know.
Hell yeah. Hell
but
yeah.
That must have been a great... I love that fucking movie.
We had an amazing time.
Oh, my God.
And some of my fondest memories of any kind of shooting were, I'm sure, I don't know if you ever, did he talk to you about the KC-135, the vomit comet?
No.
Okay, well, those are two things. First off, when we were in the first, the initial launch in the capsule, some of that we did on a soundstage.
Uh-huh.
And it was, we would get strapped in because we were in our, you know, it's giant spacesuits, and we couldn't really move too much for a really long time.
Yeah.
But we had communication between Tom and Bill and Ron and I, and we could sort of like hear each other, and we would hear each other just for like 2-3 hours, just in between shots while they're setting up.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever laughed as long or as hard, and I wish I could. I wish somebody had fucking recorded it, because
just you guys in spacesuits.
Because Bill is hilarious, and Tom is hilarious, and Ron's like kind of like little reactions to us. I mean, we had such a blast. But there's a back then, in order to create weightlessness, you would need harnesses and straps, and then you would try to paint those things out, and it was pretty rudimentary. And these days, no problem. You know, I just saw life, you know, they're floating through the whole movie.
Sure.
And it's, you know, it's all kind of digital stuff. There's a plane called the KC-135, also known as a vomit comet, that NASA has, where they use to train astronauts and to create weightlessness on Earth, which is impossible. People think there's such a thing as an anti-gravity chamber. There's no such thing.
Right.
What the plane does is it goes out of the Gulf of Mexico and it climbs straight up. It's like a big ass plane, like a 707 or something like that. Climbs straight up and then dives, and straight up and dives, and they're called parabolas.
Yeah.
And when you go over the top the combination of centrifugal force throwing you back up, you know, like a roller coaster, and the gravitational pull balance out for 25 seconds.
Yeah.
And so we had to go up there to experience that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm like, this is terrifying and nauseating. They call it the vomit coma.
Yeah, yeah.
And we go and we do it. And we, you know, I think you do 20 out and 20 back. And then, you know, we came down, we landed. It was so fun. Well, we experienced weightlessness. That's so cool. And, you know, high-fiving and the whole thing. And we're kissing the ground. Ron has a conversation with Steven Spielberg, who says to him, why don't you shoot the movie up there? And then you'll have actual weightlessness. Just build the set and shoot it up there. And he comes back to us. And he's like, guys, I got a great, exciting. I'm like, oh, fuck, you're kidding me. And we go out down to Houston and shot quite a lot of stuff in a airplane hurtling up and down and up and down. 600 times we did it.
Oh my God.
And
so you got used to it.
So
25 seconds at a time.
So 25 seconds at a time, but you know, that's a fairly long time to get a shot. Then you'd get another one, and you're you know, the camera's floating, so it can all be kind of like handheld.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, literally like, you know, bite the water out of the air thing. And we would, if we weren't in the scene, we'd play in the back of the airplane, play football. And like, I mean, you could fly like Peter Pan, I mean, up and down. So as I was speaking of Paxton, you know, as a bonding sort of experience, that was amazing. And Bill and Tom were way more gung-ho than me. I'm like, I got a family, because it's, you know, it's terrifying. And we also had to take some very, very serious drugs to combat the nausea. So we were all a little bit like kind of, you know, druggy in a weird sort of way. But anyway, it was great. We had such a blast. And he was so gung-ho. Man, this is the greatest. I can't believe it. I mean, you could not be in a bad mood around that guy on the set, you know, because he was so enthusiastic about the process of making movies.
He loved it. Yeah. I just watched Mystic River. It's one of those movies, if it's on, I'm going to watch it from wherever it's on. And I like doing that. I'd rather than, you know, choose a movie to watch, flip around and go like, oh shit, the good part's coming. Mm. But like those scenes with you, again, this vulnerability that you're able to offer up on those bits on the phone. Mm. But that moment, look at me, I'm like that idiot. That moment where you say to Sean Penn, what'd you do?
Huh.
That was like, oh my God. And the fact is, like, you know, I'll ask you this because I just noticed it the last time. Is that, you know him, you know Sean Penn's character, you guys come up in the same area and you knew what he did. And, you know, and he knew what he did. And then there was the morality of the script is that, well, he did kill somebody. But, you know, but in that movie, I don't know how the book is written or how you thought of it. Are you going to get Sean Penn?
Because I take my finger and I make it into a gun.
And you pull the trigger.
Yeah, we're at the parade. I'll tell you an interesting thing about that. I went to Clint, and I'm sure you've heard this before, but Clint is not somebody who wants to talk too much about motivation and those types of things. No, he really does. He wants you to go home, go into your room, do whatever you need to do, and come to work with your shit.
I heard that about, like, that's an interesting thing that I'm learning from. I just talked to Walter Hill,
mm-hmm.
and he said that this whole idea of directors directing actors is a kind of a myth. And he said it's sort of like they do a job. You hire them to do the job.
Right.
You chose them for the job they do,
right.
So do your job.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And horrible name dropping here, but Meryl Streep said to me when we were doing The River Wild, she said, you have to work with Clint. You're going to love it because you like to work in that way where you figured it out. And Meryl's like that. I mean, she would take directions certainly, but like when she comes to work, it's not like she's discovering the character.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Made choices. And Clint's very much like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'll only do one take. Sometimes he'll shoot the rehearsal. Everything is very, very, you know. So all of a sudden, all of us went, "Ooh, fuck, we got to get our shit together." Like, we're not, you know, it's not going to be 18 takes,
right?
You know, whatever. So we actually started to kind of like rehearse on our own, and
it was you and Sean,
and me and Sean and Tim and Fish. You know, we would get together and read through the script and stuff, and Clint was never there, you know. So rarely did I ask him,
right?
Because I knew that wasn't his thing,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But at that moment, I said, "So, Clint, what is that I'm doing there?"
It was in the script too.
It was in the script, yeah. To take that. Yeah. It might have even been in the book. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, that's for the audience to decide."
Mm.
And so I said, "Okay, I'm going to make a choice, but I'm going to take that to my grave, because if he wanted it to be for the audience to decide, then I'm going to, you know, honor that."
I know what it was.
Okay.
You're going to get him.
Okay.
Oh! Actor secrets are sort of, for me, they, like, I've had this happen once before. I'm like, what do you get to lose by telling us now?
It's the only moment that I've ever done that I will hold on to. But look, I think that's a very astute observation.
Well, it's so weird that, like, I bring it up to you and I have this opportunity to talk to you, because, you know, after seeing that movie like 6 or 7 times, really, in bits and pieces, and a few times all the way through, that struck me, and that was like just a week or so ago. It was on cable, and I was like, oh, I didn't, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't know what is the real bond ultimately that these guys really have.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing, is that could be interpreted as, you know, listen, you know me, I know you, we're cool.
No, I didn't see
you know
that. Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And like, when you work with Merle or Sean, or like, you know, are you guys, like, do you find yourself like ever gleaning things, like, or are you set in your ways? When you work with an actor, do you do a scene and go like, "Wow, fucking Sean nailed that," or do you know?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I think that you try as much as possible not to step outside and start watching what you're doing, because you really have to be listening.
You
got to
fight that sometimes, don't you?
Yeah, you do. You do sometimes have to fight it, but you really feel like you have to. You know, I, especially even as I get, you know, older, I mean, it's like I really want to experience staying just kind of in it, you know, like the difference between the time when you're waiting to go on to the time when they say action. In a way, I'm trying to learn how to make that sort of flow into one thing. And to really feel like I'm walking in this person's shoes, not pretending to be the guy. Like, I don't make people call me by the character name,
right,
and stuff like that. But I want to feel like I'm walking in another man's shoes at this time. So to actually stop and step out, either and look at my own work or look at the work of the person that I'm working with, is kind of counterproductive. That being said, I don't look at you know, Jack Nicholson saying, "You can't handle the truth." You know, I'm going, "Oh, fuck, this guy's nailing this. Oh my God, is this good?" You know, I can't, you know, of course I'm going to see that.
Even when he doesn't have to do the other side because they're doing a single, he'll do it. Like, I don't know if you had that experience with him.
He did it again.
Right.
Again. It was one of the most, I have so much respect for him. What was funny about it was that if you think about that particular scene in A Few Good Men, I mean, shooting a courtroom there's a lot of coverage that you have to get, because you got to get Jack, and then obviously, you know, they shot his side of things out first, you know, maybe 3-4 sizes on him. Amazing. You know, he's going to be off camera for the rest of the day. Now you're turning back around on Tom and Demi and me and Kevin Pollak, and, you know, it's like there's a lot of pieces that you got to get. He just kept doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it. And for every single one of us, it was just as cool. But what changed was that, you know, those Marine uniforms are just really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, they make them so that you're not comfortable in them.
Right.
You know, they're made to, you know, feel like shit. I mean, he starts taking his jacket off, then his, you know, he's got his tie off, and then his hair starts getting all, you know what I mean? So
by the end of the day.
By the end of the day, he's still doing it, but he's like this, you know, kind of like he's more Nicholson than he is, you know.
Right, right.
You know.
He's comfortable.
Yeah, it was great.
Okay, so let's talk about I Love Dick, because, you know, I know Jill and, mm-hmm. and Catherine I love, and I think I'm going to get to talk to Griffin. I've met him once or twice.
He's great.
But, yeah, he is great. He's doing a good job in that.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I got to watch the rest of him.
Yeah, please do.
No, I will.
Because it gets very, oh, boy, it really goes all kinds of pretty interesting places.
But like I said, being with an artist who's in that level of art, you know, like who sells paintings, she does well for herself, mm. and getting to know that community a little bit, but still feeling outside of it. It's a very insulated, odd world.
Yes.
Which is really great for a TV for a show, mm-hmm. because it doesn't seem fictional at all, but it's definitely outside of almost everyone's experience. Mm. So what was the pitch for you? How did you get involved with it?
I got...
Because you're Dick.
I'm Dick. I am. I got a call that Jill Soloway had a new show, and it was called I Love Dick, and that I was Dick. I mentioned it to my wife, and she said, so you're doing that one? I was like, well, honey, I haven't read the script yet. She's like, oh, no, you're doing it. It's Soloway, and Catherine was attached already.
She's great.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Oh, my God.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
And then I spoke to a couple other women that in my life, maybe my daughter, one of my sisters, whatever. They're all saying the same thing. You're doing that one, dude. And then I read the script. I loved it.
Yeah.
And Jill and I got on the Skype, and she was in L.A. I was on the East Coast, and we spoke about it. And you know, it was important to her. I think at this point, or maybe always, I don't know, I haven't known her before this, but the notion of having a good person, somebody that was going to be a positive kind of influence and a positive vibe on the set was like, yeah, really super important to her.
Yeah.
You know, she's kind of like, I hear you're nice, but I don't, you know, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was important to me was to know whether or not this character was just going to be objectified, or which is cool, but whether you were ever going to get to know him and get a little bit deeper into who he is. And she promised me that you would, and then we sort of began the process, and I feel like, especially in the last few episodes, they kind of delivered on that promise.
Well, the book was sort of controversial in that community, mm-hmm. from what I understand. That you know, I don't think I'm speaking out of school really, but I mean, it's based on a real book by this Chris Krause person.
Yes, yeah.
Who went on this this thing? This what do you call him? The what is that situation there? A residence, artist, yeah, residence, mm-hmm. in Marfa, which is now like sort of the capital of art.
Have you been there?
No, I haven't been there yet.
Yeah. That's cool. You should go.
I'll go. We're going to go. I'll check it out.
Yeah,
but it's really a kind of the sort of the idea that this woman who in the show is not an artist per se, and becomes immediately obsessed with you, and then, you know, starts to present her this art project as this, you know, these documents, these letters of obsession and things that, and you don't, you know, from the point I'm at is that there's a moment there where you're like, this person's crazy, or this is,
sure.
You know, and that like your character is just holding strong to this onslaught of obsessive, you know, insecurity and need. And it's like, did you talk to the real Dick?
No, I don't think he would want to talk to me. He was not happy about the book. The book is written sort of as a semi, I mean, it really is a memoir, but it's kind of presented almost like a novel, I think.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. And in the book, you learn very little about him. And
it's more about her.
It's really more about her and about Silvera, about her husband. And what I really wanted to do was make sure that I could create a character that had some more kind of depth and interest. And one of the people that I latched onto, see, the book actually takes place in like Northern California.
Yeah.
Had Marfa had nothing to do with it. Marfa, yeah. Marfa, Texas. But Marfa, Texas was, there's a character there named Donald Judd, uh-huh. who was a famous sculptor, uh-huh. Living in New York, who had driven through Marfa, Texas when he was a young man in the army and remembered it. And he left New York and went to Marfa, Texas and started buying up buildings and ranches.
He was the guy.
Yeah. And he's very, very, I would say, probably a lot more similar to Dick than to the Dick in the book.
Right.
And one of the things that I really wanted to explore with this was the nature of celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dick is a very big fish in a very small pond.
Yeah.
And he has, Donald Judd, for instance, was a successful sculptor in New York, but maybe wasn't the most famous sculptor in New York.
Yeah, of course.
And went to this tiny, tiny little town in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's West Texas. It takes 3 hours to get there from El Paso. That's the closest, you know, airport, really.
Really?
Yeah, it's very hard to get to.
Yeah.
And he created a world where he was a king.
Yeah.
He was, you everybody knew him. Everybody knows every move and everything he does.
Right.
And that to me is a lot like what being an actor is kind of like.
Yeah.
You try to create a world where you are the subject of attention and of focus. And then once you've created that, you sometimes have a difficult relationship with that notion.
Right.
And that's what is going on for this guy.
From the beginning, that's where you were going. That's the work you did. Those are the choices you're making, yes, based on that dynamic within yourself.
Yes.
And
you know, women throw themselves at Dick, and this woman is no exception, you know. And I think that when we were kind of talking about this before, but you know, when people hang on every word, admire you, tell you that they love you and they love your work and all those kinds of things. On one hand, it's like amazingly great and it makes you feel so good all the time.
Right.
But on the other hand, you're always kind of struggling going, maybe, is any of this deserved?
Yeah, right? You don't know me.
Yeah. Or have I done anything that really is any good?
And, right.
You know, I don't know if you probably maybe not gotten there, but they talk about in the show that I haven't made any art in 7 years, and that
there was that one yelling. I think when she yells at you, haven't done anything in that.
Yeah.
When she shows up to audit the class,
right,
she's done all her homework.
Yeah, you haven't made anything, you know. So I think that's where he's at in his life, is that he's struggling with this undeserved celebrity.
And then you do make something, you retitle the brick piece.
Yes.
I love that beat. That's funny, man. That was a funny beat.
I make it with a pen.
Yeah. Well, now I'm excited to watch the rest of it. And I think it's a great world. I think it's I didn't know how I was going to feel about it, but the weird menace of, you know, you're at this point where I am in the series, you're still pretty detached, but whatever's going on with Griffin and Catherine and that unraveling, and then these other surrounding artists, that one scene where they try to rehearse that play, it was like, it's really hard not to make that stuff look, I don't know if trite's the right word or hackneyed, but, you know, having been with an artist for a while now, it's like they live in a very specific space, artists.
Yes.
And it's all very earnest, and it's all very, you know, they are taking risks, but it just seems very insulated. And I think that, you know, that to do that for a broader audience, there's some traps to that, but it seems that you've avoided it.
Well, I think that you make a really good point, but I also think that even within trying to make it not look hackneyed, I think Jill is also willing to say maybe sometimes it is, Do you know what I mean?
Oh, no, absolutely. You know? Yeah, this, maybe it's okay if this looks ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And I think that's a really fine line to walk. Plus, the other thing is that, brilliantly, they have chosen to intercut these kind of art films.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Made by women, these strange like...
One of them had a profound impact on my girlfriend. Like, when she saw it, she's like, oh, my God, that, I saw that at the show.
And she had already seen it.
The milk one.
Oh, the milk. Oh, that's crazy, right?
Yeah, it's great.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great. I saw the whole one. It goes on and on and on. And
yeah.
On. But anyway, yeah. You know, one of the things that's kind of cool is that I have a long history, besides like the mainstream movies that I've, you know, tried to make. I've always gone back to sort of like indie art house type, mm-hmm. type things because I feel like, whatever, you know, you don't get paid and you're making movie art, and you know, it's harder and harder to get that kind of stuff done in films these days because there's very little spot for it,
right?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so you're really struggling. You're struggling at film festivals, and you're struggling to make this kind of art. But Isle of Dick is like an art house movie. You know, an art house. You know
sure.
what I mean? It's very experimental in the way that it's shot, and the way that it's cut, and the kind of music that it's, even in the way that we approached it from an acting standpoint. So that was really kind of fun for me. I was like, this is fucking cool, man. This is like being back, you know,
yeah,
doing some little crazy movie in the streets of New York.
Right.
Know? There's a great director named Andrea Arnold who directed two really stunning movies. If you haven't seen them, one is called Fish Tank and one is called American Honey. She's a British director that Jill really admired, and they're super like art house, you know, kind of movies. Brilliant, both of them. But she directed four of our episodes, which we were thrilled to kind of have her. And I'll give you an example. One of the things that she does, which is fascinating to me, is that you'll do a take, you know, a couple of takes, and then we'll do a silent take where we just take all the words out and we just sort of play the scene with physicality or a look or just a feeling.
Yeah,
I've never done that in my life as an actor, and you know, I've done a lot of shit.
Yeah,
and I was like, this is like mind blowing.
Yeah,
it's really, really cool.
And how is she going to use that?
And you cut little pieces.
Oh, really?
And if you look at the show, you'll see that there's just moments that are just kind of like, look at that. Look at her eye, just for a second there, or just a hand on a leg, uh-huh. or something.
Right, right.
You know, they are sometimes from these silent.
Oh,
takes.
that's a trip. So that's exciting. Doing something new.
Totally.
And that must be great at you know where you're at in your career to actually be like, all right, I've never done this before.
Yeah, definitely. And I was a little bit resistant to it, frankly, because, you know, I'm old and jaded and bitter, you know, whatever. And my wife just kept saying to me, just leave your heart open, you know, just leave yourself open to, you don't, you know, even at this level of experience, you don't know everything there is to know about acting and making movies and you know, the process.
Yeah.
So just leave yourself open, you know, to a certain extent.
Oh, it sounds like you got a good partner there.
Oh, yeah, she's good. Yeah. She's smart.
And you respect each other, craft.
We do.
Yeah. Well, it was great talking to you, Kevin. I appreciate you taking the time.
You too, man. It was really fun.
All right.
Really enjoyed it.
That was great. I love talking to Kevin Bacon. Solid dude. Good guy. I am in a hotel room. I do not have my guitar. I am just going to sign off. Boomer lives! Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.